wish yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the subject today is the growing red flags being raised about the global economy from a host of different directions, some of them even mainstream and conservative. It can't be ignored. In other words, the global economy, both the real and the financial side of that economy, are growing more fragile. Fragile, meaning more prone to volatility, contraction, crisis, etc. That's what fragility means. It means that it's on the verge. It's more sensitive to and could simply change direction significantly. An instability event, a financial instability event, is what it actually does. Okay, in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, I attempted to identify how you estimate the degree of fragility, and not only qualitatively, but quantitatively as well. I believe an index, a quantitative index, can be created, and I'm working on that with other data scientists right now who will help me quantify, create an index of at what point does the financial side of the economy about to enter a crisis, a contraction, a contagion. Okay, so we'll be talking about that more next year, unless, of course, this thing actually does flip before that, which is a possibility. Okay, let's do a little review of some of the statements being made by various sources about the fragility in the global economy, both on the real side, in other words, about to or approaching global recession, and on the financial side, about to undergo a financial instability event. And of course, the two are related. The financial instability precipitates, exacerbates the real decline of the economy, and of course, it's vice versa as well. The weakening real economy provides an indicator to investors to pull their investments, which leads to financial asset price deflation, which can lead to defaults. And when you have defaults, you have a collapse of investment and bank lending. And that, of course, spills over back again to the real economy. That's how the two financial and real cycles, real business cycles, are related. It's a mutual feedback effect that occurs, which is contrary to mainstream economics, which kind of poo-poos what goes on the financial side. Because, as I've said many times, mainstream economists aren't trained in looking at financial indicators, pretty much. They're trained in the national income accounts, which pretty much disregard financial instability and financial events. Thus, they have no sense of financial cycles, only real cycles. And if in the 21st century, financial cycles and real cycles interact more and more, well, then they don't forecast very well, right? They don't see these things coming. Well, they're getting a little better at it, because of 2008-09, they got a long way to go. And the same thing, Marxist economists are even worse, at least Anglo-American Marxist economists. They think everything is driven by the real side and real side profits. you know, the falling rate of profit tendency, as they say. But when they say profits, they mean only profits from making real goods, real things, you know, services mostly, and financial profits and so forth are totally irrelevant, according to contemporary Marxists, at least Anglo-American types, which are really the weakest of all the global Marxist economists. And they're wrong, of course, as well, and can't forecast either. And they need to bring Marx into the 21st century. You know, they still think this is classical economics in mid-19th century Europe. It's not. All right, so enough of, you know, debunking my competitors left and right. Let's talk about indicators of the global economy. Well, some of the statements are interesting. Well, J.P. Morgan Research, what did they say? The next financial crisis will strike in 2020. Quote, that's a quote. The next financial crisis will strike 2020. Okay, well, they're pretty close to my prediction. I'm saying second half 2019. It'll come even sooner if the Fed continues to raise rates faster, because most mainstream and business economists do not think that the crunch will come until the 10-year Treasury bond is at 3.7 or above. That's the consensus. It's at about 3.1 now. So that means you'll get 3 to 4 maybe federal funds rates from the central bank, the Fed, before your 10-year gets to 3.7. I say, no, it's going to happen before then. Well, what I'm saying is that the 10-year T-bill can't rise more than 3.5 or less even before they precipitate the next crisis, which means the Fed federal funds rate now at 2.25 won't go more than 2.75, maybe 2.5, 2.5. They're pretty damn close to that, because we always have the Fed precipitating the crisis, you see? Precipitating, not causing, but precipitating it by raising interest rates too much too fast. Well, it did that in 2008, didn't it? It raised the interest rates to 5.25%, the federal funds rate, 5.25%. It kept raising it even though the recession had already begun in late 2007. It kept raising it into 2008. It's always behind the curve. Too little, too late, or too much, too fast. Well, right now they're in a too much, too fast mode. And before, in 2007-08, they were in a too little, too late mode. Fed always does that. It precipitates the crisis. In other words, the fragility and the behavior, the consciousness of investors and buyers and households and so forth is already fragile, looking for an excuse, in the case of investors, to pull their money and run. In other words, they think the cycle has peaked, time to get out, right? And they pull their money and run. And they keep investing until they get signals that it's time to get out. And this getting out can happen unpredictably. It can be a political event. It could be a bank default here or there, even a non-bank default. It could be a whole number of things. You can't read. No one really understands totally investor psychology. But we do know that as long as the market prices keep rising, various financial markets, they'll keep investing. But at some point, they'll stop investing and run, and then the market prices, financial asset prices, will collapse. Well, we can see around the world the beginning of financial assets, just the beginning to turn into a contraction phase. And that's the signal for investors to run. And if they run, then there's no money credit for real businesses to invest, and banks pull back, and that's how it spills over from pure financial asset markets to the real economy. All right, so we said J.P. Morgan said next financial crisis will strike 2020, unquote. Well, Forbes magazine, quote, 2020s may be the worst decade in U.S. history, triggered by contagion from a global credit crisis, unquote. Okay, so they're seeing it from that direction as well. 2020s can be a very unstable financial economic decade. And they're saying 2020s. That's sort of the consensus, you know, that sometime in the 2020s. But that's based upon this consensus of T-bonds 10 years at 3.7. And I'm saying it'll be well before 3.5 that it will precipitate. And if the Fed keeps raising rates, as it says it will, four more times through this year and into the next, then it will precipitate this process earlier rather than later. So, you know, if you're an investor out there, one, maybe two at the most, more Fed rate hikes, and then bar the door. You know, the next Fed rate hike is coming in December, and it looks very likely it's going to happen unless there's some shock occurring in November. And then maybe even less likely one more in March, February or March. And that'll be it, I think. The Fed will precipitate. You see, you got to distinguish between causes which are precipitating causes, causes which are enabling causes, and causes which are fundamental. And most mainstream economists don't look at it that way. Oh, here's another quote from Moody's Analytics. Moody's, of course, is one of the key three companies that rating companies. Its head there, Mark Zandi, says, quote, 2020 is a real inflection point, unquote. And then there's Martin Wolf, who's one of the preeminent business economist editorialists at the Financial Times out of London. And he's a good indicator of how the London business economists and financial elite are looking at it. He says, quote, the world's economy and financial systems are fragile, unquote. And then we have the well-positioned economist, well-positioned in government and business circles here, Martin Feldstein at Harvard, who in a Wall Street Journal editorial in September says, quote, the high level of asset prices today, meaning stocks, mirrors the earlier trend in house prices that preceded the 2008 crash, unquote. Yes, he's right. This isn't going to be a housing crisis crash. This is going to be a good old-fashioned stock and bond market crash. Going to look more like the dot-com crash of 2000, 2001, and other markets as well. In some ways, I think it's going to have elements of the 1997-98 Asian currency meltdown, another global financial crash that occurred, because obviously currency exchange rates, which are financial assets for currencies, foreign exchange currencies, it's another financial asset, will be involved in this next one as well. So stock markets, stock prices, we're already seeing stocks in a deep retreat outside the U.S., a modest retreat in Europe and in Japan, but outside the U.S., feeling the brunt of this first, you see. So what's happening in emerging market economies is going to be central to all this next time as well. When you get a stock market deep decline, which Feldstein is referencing here, you get a significant decline in consumer spending. And when that happens, of course, then it spills over through that transmission channel to the real economy. Spending declines as well. When you have an income, a wealth effect, a decline from a stock market crash. And Feldstein talks in his article about The S&P 500 stocks, the P/E historic ratio, is historically 40% lower than it is today. In other words, S&P stocks, S&P 500, the largest 500 corporations in the U.S., are overvalued in terms of price by more than 40%. And he's saying that if it contracts back to its historical average by 40%, right, that's going to be a loss of $10 trillion in GDP, or a 2% decline in GDP. All right, that means recession, right? Just from that effect. So the Federal Reserve goal is to raise its rates, the federal funds rate, the short-term benchmark rate, to 3.4, he says, which is now 2.25%. So he's saying the Fed's goal is to raise rates 4 to 5 more times. Well, the Fed is admitting 4 more times. One more in December, 3 more next year. And then actually one more, I think, in 2020. That's as far as it's going in its prediction. Okay. But what matters is what's called the real yield on interest, right? What's the real yield? Well, you got the nominal actual interest rate of 2.25% here, but inflation is running about 2.7, 2.9%, and you've got 10-year bond rates about that. So it's about neutral. We're almost at neutral. But the Fed wants to raise rates a little higher than neutral because it says inflation is rising. Actually, it's rising faster than 2.9% because of, Trump, his tariff wars here, raising prices across the board, his policies, Trump policies with regard to healthcare and prescription drugs and aluminum and steel and so forth, is raising prices everywhere. And that has a lot to do with his tax cuts as well. So the federal funds rate would have to rise, three or four times here. And I'm saying, no, only 1 or 2 times, and that's going to precipitate the financial markets contraction retreats, which is going to reduce investment business, real investment, and consumer household spending. Now, what's really going gangbusters on GDP, and which is really responsible for GDP figures in the U.S. for this year, is defense spending. That's what's boosting it. Officially the deal was a $165 billion increase in defense spending. Well, that's Pentagon spending. That does not reflect additional related spending on, quote, defense or war from other departments, Energy Department, Veterans Affairs and so forth. You got to add to that. That's only Pentagon. See, Pentagon is not the total story for defense spending. It's the biggest chunk of it, but it's not the total picture. There's more than almost $700 billion in spending. All Trump's projected increase in the nuclear arsenal of the U.S., is in the Energy Department budget, atomic energy. That's where that spending is. It's not Pentagon. And then they don't always count the operating theater expenses, in other words, direct expenses for war. And that's still going on in Afghanistan. Who knows how much. That's not included in the defense budget. But even so, the defense budget, $165 billion, over 2 years, almost $100 billionaire a year, I would say, you added another $20, $25 billion there for other costs in other departments. So it's like $100 billion a year. But that doesn't even cover it all because there's what's called the block budget, off budget. special secret military equipment programs. That's not in any of the budget reports in the print. It's not printed for the public, and in fact, only key members of Congress on the Armed Services Committee get to see what it is, but it's not printed, you see. 10, 15 years ago, it was about $50 billion a year. I wouldn't doubt it's even more than that a year. So I would say they're probably raising the black budget by 10 to 20 billion a year. You know, so you're really talking about $250 billion in just the 2 years, starting at the beginning of this year, in defense spending. Well, that's front-loaded here this year, and that has a lot to do with the GDP numbers. Government spending on defense, not on the rest, is what's really driving the increase in Trump 3% GDP. Well, three to four, whatever it was. You see, it's a very short term, all designed to pump up the economy before the midterm elections coming up. You see, they always do that before elections. They concentrate the government defense spending to get the biggest boost so they can claim the economy is doing better than it is. And then it has to make up for it in the fourth quarter and the first quarter next year. Watch the first quarter next year, 2019, being very, very weak. All right. So I think we got a GDP, a new number. I haven't seen it yet for today. Preliminary GDP. You know, there's like three publicized GDP numbers every quarter. Preliminary does not include all the economy. The second one, revised, is the most significant if it revises. And then you have months later, very token changes further. Okay, I don't know what that is today. I'll have to look. But I do know that Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is bragging or predicting that we're going to have a 3% plus annual GDP growth every year for the next 4 to 5 years. I think he's smoking some of that new legal stuff, right? No way. No way. 3% for 4 to 5 years. That means no recession for 4 to 5 years. And I guess all the economists and IMF and everyone else is wrong when they say, and J.P. Morgan and Forbes and Moody's are all wrong when they say 2020, you know, is going to be a problem. Yeah, well, that's all based on phony assumptions, and forecasts of the government are probably the least, at least out of the White House. And out of the administration, Commerce Department that supports the White House, and so forth, Congressional Budget Office might be a little more accurate. Okay, so some interesting predictions here, right? B of A, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch has just produced a survey this month that said 85% of business investors see global growth in the quote late stage of the cycle. Even the IMF, International Monetary Fund's director, Christine Lagarde, says the problem, quote, it's not just clouds on the horizon. It's a bit more than a drizzle. You know, when they don't really want to make a forecast, they use metaphors. So even most of the mainstream sees a problem come in the global economy. So let's look a little bit at the real side of the economy globally. What's happening? Well, we've been talking a lot about emerging markets, many of whom are tripping over into recessions right now, some of them very deep, like in Latin America. You've got Argentina and Brazil. Of course, you'll get a little boost in Brazil if this proto-fascist here, Bolsonaro, wins. The business sector will love it. But interest rates are way up in the double-digit level in both of those countries. Even Turkey now, interest rates of central bank have been raised to 24%. excuse me, rates are rising in Indonesia and other places in Asia, all because the currency is collapsing, you see. Their currencies are collapsing, as we've been talking about, and their currencies are collapsing for a number of reasons, but fundamentally it's because the U.S. dollar has been rising. You know, as the dollar goes up, it's the global currency. All currencies respond in relation to it. If the dollar goes up, ipso facto, the other currencies go down. And if the economies and markets in those countries are also in contraction, the currency goes down even further. Well, why does it go down? Well, because if you're holding those currencies that are falling in value, and you're an investor or a corporation or whatever, you're going to sell those currencies, dump them, and buy dollars that are rising. Because if you don't, if you hold your profits in Argentine pesos, they're going to lose value. You're going to have a profit contraction just from a exchange rate point of view. And if you're a U.S. multinational company doing business in Argentina, you know, you don't want to book those losses for currency reasons, so you sell the currency and buy dollars that are going up and see a dollar profit. Well, investors, institutional and individual alike, you know, dump their currencies, which puts more of a supply of those currencies on the market, which drops the price. Simple supply and demand. And demand for to buy more dollars raises the dollars even more. And then speculators, currency, foreign exchange speculators jump in and they see the currencies that are going down and dollar going up, and they throw big pots of money at both the downturn and the upturn of the dollar. They speculate on the movement of those currency prices to make money, which drives, you know, the emerging market currencies down even more and the dollar up even more, you see. They play the same game, by the way, with commodities, particularly oil commodities. Most of the change in oil prices, you know, you see from day to day is not because of some big change in supply or demand for oil. It's speculators buying oil in spot markets, driving the price up and down, buying contracts, you see. All assets are like that. And oil is an asset. It's a financial asset. It's not just a commodity. You know. Okay, so emerging markets, their stocks or stock markets are in deep contraction. If you average them out, emerging market stock markets are down 20%, which means their bond interest rates are going up, which is a nice speculative play for global speculators, drives them up even more, and that drives up interest rates and slows down the business borrowing and business hiring and production, and thus throws these countries into recessions. You know, Argentina, Brazil, Pakistan, South Africa, you know, Turkey, they're all in recession. Just a question of how deep, and it will grow deeper. And that's why the IMF has to bail them out. See, Argentina already has gotten a $57 billion bailout. Pakistan has asked for $7 billion, and they'll be asking for more. And other countries will soon be at. I mean, this is going to be interesting because the IMF just doesn't have the funding to bail out at $50 billion plus all these coming emerging markets. Where is it going to get its money? From the U.S.? You know, the funding in the IMF is by the contributing nations. I don't think Trump is going to increase the budget for the IMF. And it's going to be very interesting what happens when the IMF says to one or more of these countries, nope, we can't give you a loan. Well, then you got a big default on government bonds, which who knows what the contagion will that be, the contagion effect. First across other government bonds, and then who knows other financial markets. You see, the global market's so integrated that the contagion is today so significant and can move so rapidly and bring down the whole global economy. And they don't know. Economists don't understand contagion effects. In other words, what will spread to what, at what rate, with what consequences? They don't know. They have no idea. We're already seeing some contagion with Italian bonds, you know. Italian bond, we'll talk about those a little shortly, but Italian bonds are going up, and the speculators are now driving it up a little more. Bond prices going down, which means Italian banks are going to be in deep trouble because they're holding so much government, Italian government bonds. And the contagion looks like it's spreading to early stages to Spain and Portugal. Okay, so Eurozone, the UK, what does that look like? Well, it's slowing. The economy is slowing. Once again, you know, it only got to a 2% growth rate here last year, following on the U.S. The European economy is becoming an appendage of the American economy in some ways. Okay, so the central bank chairman, Mario Draghi, says, oh, no, this is not a slowdown. This is just a, quote, weaker momentum. Yeah. Mario is the master of obfuscating phrases, you see. He's the source of when Europe was in its deep double-dip recession there in 2012, comes out and says the central bank will, quote, do whatever it takes, unquote. And that, interpreted by investors that, oh, well, he's going to pump all this free money, and of course he did. So now it's weaker momentum. Bureaucrat talk for slowing economy. The ECB, European Central Bank, has just reiterated this week that it will end its bond buying program, which is now at $15 billion a month. By the way, buying corporate bonds, not just government bonds, which means he's propping up the government, the state is propping up the bond markets. In Japan, it's even worse. The Bank of Japan is propping up stock markets as well as bond markets, buying all kind of stock, buying all kind of bonds. You see, this is part of the capitalist state in the 21st century playing a bigger and bigger role in propping up and subsidizing capitalist finance and capitalist investors. Bigger role than ever before. Central bank at the center of that. And the governments, of course, as well, with more and more tax cuts for corporations and investors. This means that, either capitalism is having a harder time generating real profitability, or it means that they're getting greedier and greedier, and they've brought the state in to boost their profits even more than they would be able to obtain themselves from normal business practices. One or the other. Maybe a little bit of both. So the state is playing a bigger role in all this, and we see this with Draghi and the European Central Bank. We see it with the Bank of Japan buying up stocks, propping up the stock market investors as well as bond market investors. And in the U.S. as well, we see this increasing role of the capitalist state after 2008, you know, when the central bank stepped in and bought $5 to $6 trillion of bad investments from private investors, $5 to $6 trillion, called QE. And when that play was over, when that game was over, you know, when Yellen and Obama left office, the subsidization of corporations and investors switched to fiscal policy. Hence the Trump tax cuts, another $4 to $5 trillion for investors and bankers and corporations, multinationals and so forth. That's what it's going to cost. And of course, as I've said many times, but it's worth repeating, all you hear is this, oh, the cost is $1.5 trillion. No, it's $4 to $5 trillion with a $2 trillion increase and taxes on the middle class, which begins next year, by the way. They front-loaded the tax cuts for the wealthy investors and corporations, and they waited cleverly till after the midterms to let it hit households, the tax hikes hit households, which will really accelerate after 2024, you see. Everything that they may have given households here during the Trump administrations will start disappearing rapidly, reversing, and they'll take it all away from 2024 to 2028, you see. That's what it's all about. So, you know, big 4 to 5 trillion tax cuts offset by 2 trillion, and they go around saying, well, it's 1 to 1.5 trillion actual hit to the deficit, because they make silly assumptions about, like Mnuchin, 3% plus economic growth for the next 4 to 5 years. You see, that should produce more tax revenues that will offset these tax cuts. Should. It's all theory. But it's pretty clear that so far the tax cuts are not working in terms of generating growth. The growth is really being driven by defense spending, as we said earlier. Okay, so emerging markets, rising interest rates, collapsing stock markets and bond markets, right? Capital flight, to stop capital flight from those countries as the currency declines, they raise their interest rates. But rising interest rates in Argentina and Brazil and places like that causes a crash in their domestic economy, rising unemployment, and rising import inflation. Those countries import a lot more goods than we do, particularly critical goods like food and medicines, and all that rises. So they get inflation and more unemployment, slowing recessions to protect the values of the currency and the values of bondholders in their countries and investors in their countries. You see, they will sacrifice their economies to protect their wealth, which is what they do. And then they turn around and say, oh, it's corrupt, it's corrupt. And they point the finger at other governments that preceded them, like in Argentina and in Brazil, and say, oh, corruption, corruption. And people get confused. And, oh, yeah, corruption, right? And their press supports their allegations. And they come back in the office. And then they rape the economy even more till it gets to such a point that people can't stand it anymore. And it's clear of what they've done. But that's 3 or 4 years during which they're ripping off even more. And then another government comes in. And they convince the new government, the new popular government, not to go after him, throw him in jail. And then they wait 3 or 4 years, and here we go, the new corruption cycle. This is the cycle that's been going on for at least 3 or 4 decades since the late 1970s, in the U.S. as well. Republicans come in, they rape the economy for their rich buddies, screw it up. The Democrats come in and they make their rich buddies even richer and throw a few crumbs at the rest. Then we get a slow recovery, a poor recovery. That's Obama's record, right? And the basis for another round of Republicans coming in. This is the shell game that's been going on since at least Jimmy Carter. Well, Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon wrecks the economy. Jimmy Carter comes in, does a terrible job at recovery, sets the pace for the stage for Ronald Reagan. He comes in, creates massive deficits, and then we get Slick Bill. He comes in, and the rich get even richer. All the deregulation, right? End of pensions, rising cost of health care, all these contingent part-time temp jobs, right? All these H-1B visas coming in, taking the good jobs, creates the precondition for George W. Bush, who becomes, as far as feeding the rich friends, his Ronald Reagan on steroids. And then we get Obama. You know this story. Yeah, it's all historical record now. Yeah. And people are beginning to get wise to it all. Let's go back to Europe. What are the problems in Europe here in the global economy? Well, Brexit. This is really a comedy of errors, Brexit, you know, the UK leaving. As I predicted years ago when it just began, I said the strategy is going to be to drag it out and drag it out till people get tired over in the UK hearing about it and the economy gets worse, and then they'll have a second vote. And they'll get rid of it. That's the strategy of those opposed to Brexit. Well, it's a real battle between those and those forces that still want Brexit. And the question is, will there be a hard Brexit? In other words, UK won't come to a deal with the rest of Europe and they'll just leave? Well, that will have a tremendous negative impact on the European economy already beginning slow. The other problem in Europe is in Italy. What we got in Italy is a populist government that's taken over on the pledge that it will increase fiscal spending for the rest of the economy, not just the tax cuts for the rich or monetary stimulus for the banks, but actually try to bail out the rest of the economy, a populist government spending. Well, if you're part of the Eurozone, there are rules that say you can't increase fiscal spending. You got to rely on monetary policy. You have a ceiling on fiscal deficit spending, and you can't spend more than that, you see. That's how they keep all the rest of that's how they, meaning the northern European countries, Germany, Netherlands, and so forth, France to some extent, who run the Eurozone, they created this whole Eurozone in their favor, you see, and took away fiscal policy from all the other countries and put it in the hands of European bankers, controlled by German bankers who control German Central Bank, who control the European Central Bank. So if Italy is saying, no, we're going to bust that budget, we're going to spend to stimulate our economy, then they're going against the whole Eurozone rule. And if they do that, and it happens, that who's to stop other smaller European countries from busting their budget and busting the Eurozone, really? You know, the Greeks tried to do that a couple years ago. I wrote a book, Looting Greece, and they had a populist government called Syriza. And Syriza came into office based upon that kind of pledge that we see at the Italian populace now. And then for 6 months, they tried to fight the Eurozone and these pan-European organizations, European Commission, European Central Bank, etc. And they caved in. Their leader there, Alexis Tsipras, caved in and went over to the dark side, you see. He went over to the dark side and became, like the governments before him in Greece, the puppet, implementing the policies of the Troika, as it was called, the Northern European Eurozone power, the European Commission, Central Bank, IMF. Even though he took a vote, a popular referendum, which told him, don't cave in. He caved in and purged his party and formed a new alliance with some of the pro-business right-wing parties and has been ruling ever since. And, of course, the Greeks have been suffering ever since. They're still in depression, and nothing's getting any better. This is a new form of financial imperialism, as I wrote about in Looting Greece. You can read some of my articles and segments of that book if you're interested in that topic on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or website. Will the Italian populace break the rules of the Eurozone and get away with it? Well, if they do, that's another crisis effect, along with Brexit coming. And then you got to look at some of the banks, the Italian banks, non-performing bank loans, really bad shape. Italian banks holding a lot of government bonds. And if those rates rise and their prices fall, then, the banks are even worse shape with government bonds. Who's going to bail them out? And then there's a lot of trouble brewing with Deutsche Bank, the big investment bank in Germany, Deutsche Bank. I don't think it will survive the next crisis. And then there's the trade fight with the U.S., which is pretty much on hold still. German production and GDP and business pessimism is rising and production is falling. Interest rates will be rising here when the ECB ends. If it does end, it's QE at the end of this year. Says it will. I don't think it can. We'll see. If it does, it will exacerbate the problem further in Europe. So Europe has been a real weak link in the global capitalist system since 2008-09, and it doesn't look like it's getting any better. But elsewhere, we see other problems. South Korea is being impacted by the U.S.-China trade war and is trying to stimulate its economy now with business tax cuts and more credit. It's very, you know, South Korean households are very, very high in debt, even more indebted than households in the U.S., right? And real business investment is falling over there. So South Korea, which had moved a lot of its production to China, that's why it's being impacted by the U.S.-China trade war. So had Japan, by the way. And Japan will probably move even more to mainland China now. I mean, Prime Minister Abe is over there meeting with Xi, Prime Minister Xi of China, and they're going to cut some new deals. What about China? Well, China just indicated slowest growth since 2009 at 6.5%. You know, the Chinese economy has doubled since that time. But really, it's growing at about 5%. Because it overestimates its growth rate. So China is definitely slowing, and it is on the verge of this trade war with the U.S. I say verge because it's not really yet a full-blown trade war with China. All we've got is really $50 billion in tariffs having been imposed by both sides. There's an announced $200 billion more by Trump, but that won't take effect until January. That's when the real trade war begins, if the U.S., Trump, don't cut a deal with China before then. They're going to meet, and I think it's Buenos Aires here, next meeting with the G20, I think it is. They'll be talking on the side there and seeing in November, and seeing if they can avoid a trade war. I think they probably will, you know, because I think a lot of this trade war stuff is all part of Trump's political economic nationalism targeting his political base. You know, see how tough I am on all these foreigners? And he'll exaggerate and lie about how tough he's been when actually he's playing softball with them. As we see in a recent NAFTA 2.0 deal, real softball deal here, just like Korea, bilateral free trade deal, softball deal, just as he suspended all these other steel and aluminum tariffs on just about all the other importers to the U.S. and put the trade war with China on hold, Europe on hold, you know. There's no real trade war going on, just a lot of talk about it. But there may be with China. We'll see. You know, the Chinese are refusing to come to Washington before the November elections because they know Trump is just going to manipulate it for his political purposes. Sound like he's tough. And so they're not falling for that. And that's kind of got Washington pissed off at him. Why aren't you coming? Well, we know the game you're playing, Donald. Come on. We'll talk to you afterward in Buenos Aires, right? So I think it's most likely, particularly if the economy is slow, that there will be a resolution to this, even the China-U.S. trade war. You see, if you look at Trump's trade strategy here, he talks tough on tariffs, then he backs off and he agrees to quotas, and quotas that have a lot of leeway to them. Well, that's what happened with NAFTA recently, right? Instead of tariffs on auto parts from Mexico and cars from Mexico and Canada, right, that he was talking about, he said, okay, quotas. But the quotas were lifted. Yeah. Canada imports about 2 million cars, and the quota limit is 2.6 million. and the auto industry slowing down. So you're not getting hit 2 million, alone 2.6 million. The same thing with Mexico. 1.6 million cars imported raised to 2.6. What is that? And there's a side letter, a lot of side letters in this NAFTA deal, you see, which can be broken easily. In the NAFTA deal, the side letter, you know, says that the there can be even more quotas if the U.S. imposes a 25% tariff on auto imports worldwide. That's not going to happen. So, you know, very, very clearly, it's a lot of phony. Well, you know, they're still talking about the steel and aluminum tariffs, but none of this has actually really taken effect. You know, any of these changes still have to be voted on by Congress because they are treaty changes. And none of this is going to take effect until January, if then, with NAFTA, most of it, you know. And the same with the $200 billion on China, not until January. But, you know, the mainstream press just falls into this Trump stuff and all the hyperbole and exaggeration and reports it. And it's just what he likes. You know, this has been their era all along. He tweets and they jump. He loves it. Makes him look good to his base. The more they say he's crazy, the more his base loves him. Because his base, you know, views Donald Trump kind of like the Germans in the early Weimar Republic viewed Adolf Hitler. He can do no wrong, no matter what he does, morally or whatever, he can do no wrong. You know, that's an indicator of kind of a proto-fascist drift occurring in this country. Oh, you want to read my views on that? Got a piece here. Well, an interview, a radio interview. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I talk about, you know, some of the disturbing early parallels, I emphasize early, between the way Donald Trump is trying to run the government and his administration and appealing to popular support the way he does, and his tactics and his strategy and the similarities with early Adolf Hitler in 1921, 22, 23. You know, very, very similar in some way. I'm not saying he's a fascist, but he's on the road drifting in that direction. He, Donald, right? You can't deny the historical parallels going on. Is he a tyrant? I think he's a wannabe tyrant. You know, because he's really said, well, you know, if the Mueller indictment comes down or impeachment, you know, I'm going to pardon myself. Well, that's the definition of a tyrant, someone who thinks he's above the law. You know, it's a real myth in this country that no one's above the law. You know, that's a popular myth, kind of like Horatio Alger. You know, you work hard, you can make it. You know, that's another one of these myths that no one's above the law until they declare they are. And, of course, presidents pardon all kinds of people, and so do judges, etc. People aren't aware of it. You know, no one's above the nonsense. Okay, so, you know, China, some other problems in China here. Slowing down, $6 trillion in debt, a new debt in China, non-performing loans that are being covered up in China. Consumer spending, your latest in this slowdown, is flat. Real investment is flat. And net exports, those imports over exports, is turning negative. Stock market's down. Shanghai market is down 30%. The currency is at the pushing against a higher band. Devaluation will soon slip over into a further depreciation. There's been a crackdown in China the last 2 years on financial speculators and shadow banks, which has slowed business investment at 5.3%, the lowest ever. So stimulus, right? There's been a monetary stimulus, reducing the reserve requirement, and what's coming is tax cuts here for small businesses and households to try to get investment and spending back up. So clearly, you know, the Chinese are struggling to keep their economy growing. to go after the financial speculators, unlike here in this country, you know, we do anything but. The U.S. has launched a trade war with them, or on the verge of one. So, China is saying it's not going to devalue its currency beyond the ban. Well, we'll see. It says it's not going to stop buying U.S. Treasury bonds, which it has, slowing down. All of them are slowing down, buying Treasury bonds. That's another reason why the Fed has to keep raising rates higher to attract more, because the big buyers, China and Japan, are slowing their purchases, you see. And, of course, the massive, massive deficit caused by the Trump tax cuts. That's why rates are going to go higher. So, it's a contradiction. They're between a rock and a hard place. They got to raise rates to pay for the $1 trillion a year budget deficits in the U.S. to attract foreign funds to pay for it. They got to raise those interest rates. But raising those interest rates is going to slow down the economy, cause a financial deep correction, maybe even contraction. So they're between a rock and a hard place, but, Trump is preparing the ground for blaming the Fed for all this when he is really at the heart of the problem. He's really the one with his $100 billion a year and more coming for nuclear arms, defense increases, and his hundreds of billions of dollars a year, $300 billion a year, in tax cuts for businesses, corporations, and investors. That's the cause of the $1 trillion budget deficits we have that are going to go on for another 10 years. But listen to McConnell in the Senate. He loves this. You know why? Because now he's already talking about it. Now he's going to go after making up for the deficits by going after grandma and grandpa. Yeah, Medicare. Let's cut Medicare. Let's cut Social Security. Let's cut education. Let's cut transportation. All that discretionary spending. That's what he's going on. It's just diverting money from the rest of us to businesses and finance and investors and bankers and all the rest. And then he comes up with this phony thing about doing something about prescription drug prices. The biggest gougers, price gougers of all. The pharmaceutical industries. And guess who spends the most money in Congress and lobbyists? Big Pharma. Yeah, no wonder they get away with it. Okay, U.S. economy. I talked about the defense spending being at the core of this growth, right? The tax cuts are not paying for themselves like they said they would. Read the Wall Street Journal, October 18th, page 4. Big feature article. Housing, commercial property is clearly stalling and will start detracting from GDP. The auto sector has clearly stalled. The auto industry. Trade deficit for September was $76 billion. You know, at that rate, that's like $1 trillion a year trade deficit. Well, wasn't Trump supposed to be doing something about this? And business inventories will be next, and investment will be next. And watch for the recession in mid to late 2019. Okay, that's my take on the global economy. Next week, I'm going to talk about three performances. What are they? Well, I'm going to talk about Robert Reich's recent speech. I'm going to talk about the interesting labor play, Sweat, and about Michael Moore's movie, Fahrenheit 11/9. Yeah, and what are liberals saying about what we do about it? It's a problem in all of it. Okay, next week, tune in. We're gonna do a what do you call this? A critique, an arch critique. Later.